Okay, so that's a general outline of how the integration of belief works as I see it. And then there's quite a lot more to say about metaphysics and basically to try and create a coherent understanding of how metaphysics works or doesn't work, because I think my experience is it's easy to jump to over quick conclusions about this particular topic, and so it needs seeing in a bigger context. So the middle way, so to link this in particularly with the first talk, the middle way involves the avoidance of metaphysics, so either positive or negative. So when we're characterising the middle way, is you're avoiding, for example, either believing in the existence of God or in the non-existence of God, or believing in free will or determinism, you know, or any other pairs of metaphysical claims which involve assertion and denial of the same or overlapping things. So the goal of the middle way then is to, well, part of it is to unify belief, so to create integration of belief. Now, the middle way itself, I would see as a big provisional cognitive model. So obviously it is philosophical, it's a conceptualization of how we think things work. It's a big one in the sense that it's the result of synthesis, of plugging stuff together, of getting different ideas from different contexts, particularly Buddhism and Western traditions. But obviously to make sense at all, it has to be aware of its own fallibility. And there is an inbuilt problem, if you like, or it becomes gradually harder, and it requires more effort to maintain awareness of the fallibility of a big theory. It's easier if you've got a small theory about, you know, the behaviour of birds or something like that. You know, it's relatively easy to say, oh well, this new piece of evidence doesn't fit how scientists often do, and so that's when your new theory here. The more complex and all-embracing the theory, well, perhaps the better substantiated it is, because it's taken into account more cognitive models, but at the same time, its claim to involve awareness of its own fallibility becomes more attenuated as it goes on. So it does require, I think, a constant effort to maintain that sense of the fallibility of the middle way. But the key point, I think, is to always think of it in a comparative way. So there's not a lot of point in merely going on about the fallibility of the theory if you haven't got a better one as an alternative. So I haven't come across a better one as an alternative, which is why I'm talking like this. But obviously one may come along in future, in which case the middle way will be superseded.
Are you aware of, also on that point, that of your own investment in the middle way, and that could potentially cloud you seeing other better alternatives?
I try, but yeah, I'm yeah. But yeah, so that's something to bear in mind.
Yeah.
Just say, I think, well, I'll talk a bit about confidence later on, and I think there are grounds to be confident in the middle way on the basis of everything we've found so far. But, you know, the whole set of ideas completely falls down if it turns into a piece of metaphysics, and that's obviously a crucial point. So, going on to a little bit more about metaphysics then, and So metaphysical beliefs aren't open to experience. That's the key things that makes them metaphysical. They can't be altered or compromised. So that's one of the relatively easy ways to tell the difference between provisional theory and a piece of metaphysics. You know, something like belief in God and God having certain attributes. No, you can't tamper with that a bit. You can't change God a bit to make him slightly less infinite or whatever. Yeah. but a provisional belief, yes, it can be altered, and it's obviously the way we understand it can evolve. Particularly a larger theory also tends to have sub-elements. It tends to have constituent sub-theories, you know, like some of the aspects of integration in the middle way we've been talking about in relation to the middle way philosophy in general. You know, I've been going through a process of altering and compromising bits of middle way theory for the last 15 years. So that's, again, for me, it's a sign that it's a fallible theory. So even if you don't ditch the whole thing, you can meddle with it. Then metaphysical beliefs generally require the repression of alternatives. So in order to maintain the belief that this cognitive model with this particular explanation is the ultimate one, the desires attached to alternative beliefs have to be repressed so that you don't really consider the alternatives. So if you're really going to hang on to your faith in the metaphysical system you've got, you can't really seriously consider the alternatives or examine them. So your desire to do so will have to be kept under wraps.
Do you think, though, psychologically, it's more comfortable to look for ideas that confirm what you believe in rather than ones that negate? It's pleasanter, isn't it?
It is, definitely. Yeah. And that's confirmation bias, which I'll mention in a minute.
Yeah.
So that there are a number of aspects of this which are really about merely about human tendencies, and we just got to work with them. There's that link with desire, and then there's also this link with group membership, which again I think I mentioned in an earlier talk that if metaphysical beliefs can't be justified at all through experience, well, what function do they have? And the only alternative, it seems to me, that seems to be supported by observations of how groups and metaphysics interact, you know, is that it's group membership which motivates metaphysical belief. Whether we're talking here about religious group membership, which is an obvious type of example, you know, but it could also be political, for example, you know, what makes you continue to hold on to dogmas about the communist society? Well, you've got to stay in the party, you've got to maintain your position, you're risking part of your material support or even security if you don't, you know. So there's all these pressures that groups can bring to bear on us to make us conform, and one, you know, to maintain power relationships in effect within groups. Metaphysical beliefs is actually a very effective, almost political weapon in the armory, because if you've got a belief which everybody can identify with but is not open for individuals to come along and say, oh, well, that can't be right because look, that piece of evidence doesn't fit in with it, then you're clear, aren't you? You really can't be challenged. You've got an apparently insurmountable position. I think that's that obviously relates to some Marxist ideas about ideology and the way in which ideology supports power, and so on. Yeah. even though you can use it against Marxism as well. Okay. Another crucial point, which I've already mentioned, but it's worth reiterating, is that metaphysics consists of beliefs expressed through propositions, not words. So no individual word can be metaphysical, even if it's God or free will or whatever it is. Not symbols that aren't in sentences either, so you can't make a musical note or a picture can't be metaphysical. It's not a proposition. And also, of course, a person can't be metaphysical. So a person has a bundle of beliefs and motivations. Some of those may be metaphysical beliefs, but there's no way we could identify the whole of a person with metaphysics. So it's very likely if you think a person is metaphysical, there's some sort of projection going on at that point. Yeah, probably an archetypal one. As an example, like God is not metaphysical, but God exists. Is. Now, this is, a tricky point for people who are quite attached to atheism and like to think of God as some metaphysical in itself. But I think if we're going to engage with what God means to people who believe in God or religious people of any kind, then there's no reason why we shouldn't respect the experience as distinct from the metaphysical beliefs.
I found the example you gave yesterday of archetypes really helpful with that, and then totally thinking about Darth Vader. So Darth Vader doesn't have to be makes claims about whether he actually exists. He's just a character in a story, but obviously still very meaningful.
But particularly representing a psychic function which has been projected. So that all helps, I think, for us to relate to the idea that the most absolute, even the most absolute apparently metaphysical concept, actually there isn't such a thing as metaphysical concept, I shouldn't say that. Apparently metaphysical concept, or a concept associated with metaphysics, it does still at least partly relate to people's experience in some way. If somebody says they have an experience of God, then I have to kind of discount the metaphysical beliefs which are probably loaded up with that and associated with it. But still think, actually, well, there is an element of something going on there. Maybe somebody's had an experience of acute integration or a sense of clarity or a sense of meaningfulness in the world or a sense of harmony with the other people in the religious group, whatever it is that's actually motivating them in that belief. And that's where I think the reading Jung is really helpful, because Jung has this whole perspective where he says he doesn't believe in God, but he knows God. And what he really means by know, I think, is he experiences God, and he experiences God as an archetype. So I think Jung's book, Autobiographical Memories, Dreams, Reflections, is really good for that, I think. Anyway, so how far people are really motivated by metaphysical beliefs is going to be a complex business. There's a bit of a practical issue, really, I guess, about how we, or how far we go in criticising beliefs. Obviously, to criticise a belief and say it's not supported and so on does not condemn the person. But very often, in practice, people can't distinguish those two things. So I'd suggest that criticising people's metaphysical beliefs is only useful when the believers are capable of at least making that distinction, so they're not going to take it personally, as we often say. So part of the problem here is the self view the idea that me as a self is based on certain beliefs or essentially contains certain beliefs. So if people have metaphysical beliefs in that kind of role, if you attack or criticise those beliefs, they will feel you're attacking them as a person because of that identification. So whether the first step before you can get anywhere with argument about metaphysical beliefs is to try and unpack the bundle a bit by some means, as to, you know, to separate the maybe NVC can help with this. Yeah, to separate the beliefs from the person.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then so a few other things. Again, some of these I've mentioned already, but it's worth just bringing them together about how to spot a metaphysical belief. So metaphysical beliefs are always absolute. You can't incrementalize them, you can't have them to some extent. They're reliant on representationalism, so they will always assume that the meaning of the claim is based on its truth or falsity. They'll assume that either implicitly or explicitly. Metaphysical beliefs are dualistic, they form counter-dependent pairs. So if you can't find the counter-dependent pair, it's worth looking into that, I think. I mean, I think there are cases of slightly complex pairs, like free will and determinism I mentioned earlier, is not strictly a neat counter-dependent pair.
Yeah, this is one of the things I was talking to Barry before came on. I wanted to talk to you about. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, yeah, okay. But certainly determinism is opposed to free will, so it contradicts free will, even though the contradiction of determinism, strictly speaking, is indeterminism rather than free will. So in some cases, there's that kind of complexity, but there's always this element of contradiction, and there's a counter-dependency, for example, where between determinism as contradicting free will. Obviously part of the issue there may be the way in which we've habitually conceptualized those particular metaphysical beliefs.
We maybe can come back to this later, but
yeah.
My intuitive sense is that there's something problematic with the concept of free will, that the actual idea itself is problematic. It doesn't need a sort of an opposite to undermine it. There's a circularity within the idea of free will and some of the assumptions you need to support common concepts of free will.
Well, yes, I mean, I'd agree with you there that you could probably say that about any metaphysical belief.
That you can undermine it by that it's not valid because of its circularity rather than its...
Well, metaphysical beliefs are circular. Yeah, they're true because they're true. So I think that's just a good example of how metaphysical beliefs are self-supporting and often depend on circular arguments.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, there's a classic one to do with God as well, which I use as an example in critical thinking. How do we know God exists? So, well, it says so in the Bible. How do we know the Bible's true? Well, because God has certified what's in the Bible.
It's true.
You can get obviously very complex, intellectually sophisticated versions of that circular argument. Don't you know? Okay, and metaphysics asserts certainty where we need to recognise uncertainty. Obviously the role of scepticism, which I mentioned, comes in here. There's a basic set of arguments going back to ancient philosophy, which just remind us of the uncertainty of what we're perceiving, which can be used really to undermine the certainty claimed in any metaphysical claim at all. There's a whole list of them in my book if you want a complete list. In fact, it's right at the beginning of Middle Way Philosophy and at the beginning of Truth on the Edge as well. But just a couple of examples. I mean, there's the dream argument, you know, so anything we think might be real, you know, we could be could be dreaming it. It could be an illusion. So again, this isn't an assertion that this is the case, that we are dreaming right now, for example, but we can't rule out that possibility. And similarly, any claim that we might make is dependent on another claim of some kind. So you can question it with the why question, which I think I heard Tim talking about the other day. So any assertion you make, that's why. And then there's an infinite regression of whys, in effect, that any given statement requires further justification.
It's quite interesting, isn't it, that we cotton onto these things at a very early age. And the principal problem that you were pointing out with the circularity of all, who created God? Well, it must be a creative body, but I go, this infinite regress.
Yeah.
And kids get that at a very young age, don't they?
Yeah.
But the arguments become increasingly sophisticated, and so you kind of stop seeing that actually this is a real problem.
Yeah.
Maybe metaphysics starts at that stage when, with the why, because.
Yeah.
Stop done with it.
It's almost like an inability to actually cope with it. We psychologically find it very uncomfortable to deal with that, so we solve the problem by pretending we haven't got a problem.
Yeah. Well, that's basically a requirement to fit in with a group, isn't it? So when the dad says, because, that's basically, you're going to fit in with my power, maybe. and even things like fitting into political models or economic models at work or whatever, you've just got to assume these models in order to get your living or whatever. So all these metaphysics can be the price of group membership in all sorts of ways, in all sorts of contexts. Going on to the next point then, that metaphysical claims are unfalsifiable. Now, this is one where I've had a number of criticisms from people of a scientific bent who point out that it's not just metaphysical claims, as I'm defining them, unfalsifiable, and you can get scientific theories that appear to be unfalsifiable. And the main difficulty here seems to be, well, what do we count as a falsification? A sort of classic simple example one can use in philosophy of science is black swans and white swans. So everybody in Europe thought that all swans were white. This was a fact until the discovery of Australia, and then they found black swans in Australia, and then they sort of had to re-examine this supposed fact that all swans were white by definition. The discovery of a single black swan was sufficient to show that it wasn't true that all swans were white.
Mm-hmm.
But did it really falsify it? Was it really a swan?
Mm-hmm.
Was it a swan in the strict sense of a swan? Yeah, maybe you should categorise it differently. Maybe it's got a different sort of feet or beak or something. Yeah? Yeah. So maybe we should put it in a different category.
Yeah.
Or maybe we were just mistaken. Maybe the guy who thought he saw a black swan, he actually saw a white swan in poor light or something like this. There are always these difficulties in science with falsification and how supported it is. So I don't think you can't use falsification in a scientific sense as a sort of complete guide to metaphysics, but it's often quite a helpful pointer. If you can't come up with any way in which a metaphysical claim can be falsified, if there are no circumstances in which you can even coherently imagine there being a piece of evidence which would make you drop that belief, then it may well be metaphysical.
I get the sense that there could be scientific theories that are unfalsifiable in terms of, our practical ability to test them out. So,
yeah.
You start getting into sort of theories about the origin of the universe and multiverses and such like. And there's no, you know, as far as we understand the laws of physics, there's no way of actually getting outside of this universe to go and find another universe, you know. So, but they are quite reasonable scientific theories in the sense that they are coherent with other, falsifiable theories, you know, they're kind of extension of other things.
Yeah.
The one thing, though, I mean, I don't quite follow that, because surely it is in theory falsifiable. I mean, there might be problems with finding that black swan and then realising that actually it wasn't a falsification after all, because it turns out that it can't interbreed with, white swans, and it is actually a different species. But in theory, you could find a white swan, a black swan that is genetically identical, able to interbreed with other swans, and therefore the theory is falsifiable.
So. But yes, you can always argue about the theory, can't you? And whether the model has been specified in exactly the right way.
And doesn't it help the fact that white swans, black swans, is the reasoning model that's conducive to that, because it's inductive reasoning, which is based on probability rather than deductive reasoning, which is So it's got that safeguard in that way of reasoning, hasn't it?
Because when you're saying about you can always question the way that you've defined the idea of swan. But that in itself kind of falsifies the theory, because you're saying, well, there's a problem with this theory, there's a problem with the way that we've identified what a swan is. Because otherwise we're always in danger of doing the reverse of the true Scotsman fallacy, aren't we?
Indeed, it becomes like that.
To give due credit to the idea of falsification, we need to kind of be quite.
Yes, I mean, that the way that the Popper expressed it certainly was in terms of you very clearly lay down the conditions in which it will be falsified and the terms, the definitions of the term you're using and so on.
But even if there's vagueness around falsifiability, you're saying that actually there's multiple ways that you can spot a metaphysical belief. So, in actual fact, you don't need to rely on one.
No.
It's necessary but not sufficient kind of condition.
Yeah. And I think it would be. It's certainly difficult to explain middle wave philosophy as falsifiable in a way which would satisfy most scientists. I find, you can say, well, an alternative. If somebody comes up with an alternative theory which fits better, those are the circumstances in which I would give a middle wave philosophy. Mm-hmm. But that's not exactly a clear piece of highly specified evidence, is it?
It's sort of a pragmatic argument, isn't it?
Yeah. So that's why I'm inclined to just keep falsifiability as something which might be helpful, but I don't want to rely on it too much. I think that part of the problem is that the philosophers of science who've relied on falsifiability, particularly Popper, have tried to base it entirely on evidence. So they've tried to make it objectively, in the old-fashioned sense, justify scientific claims and show the way in which a scientific claim can be completely justified by the evidence, which is something they're never going to be able to do. At the same time, people like Popper were completely against any kind of psychological explanation for what objectivity involved. Whereas what I'm putting forward is basically a psychological account of objectivity. It's never going to be completely supported, in a way which will satisfy the classic requirements of an objective history of science, such as Popper held.
So in a sense, was he seeking ultimate truth?
He was seeking a way of saying that science was true, or justifying that science was true. And then, related to this point about falsifiability is that what will make a claim unfalsifiable is that any alleged evidence relating to a metaphysical claim can be interpreted either for or against the claim. So that's particularly the case. Again, you could see that in attempts to either prove or disprove the existence of God, that any piece of evidence you might come up with that appears related to God could be interpreted either in a way consistent with God's existence or not. And you can apply that to any other kind of metaphysical claim, really. But as I say, that's just a pointer, more than anything. Okay, and that means that another thing that appeals to metaphysics involve is an avoidance of responsibility. I think that part of what we're responsible for is our interpretation of what we experience. When we put forward a belief and say, well, that's justified by this experience here, we have to take on board that there's an interpretation involved. There isn't a simple one-to-one justification. Oh yes, I've seen a black swan or whatever it is, therefore this must be true. We recognize, okay, it seems like it's true, and so I am going to confidently assert it's true, whilst taking responsibility for the fact that I'm taking that interpretation. There's this element of responsibility that needs to be involved, which metaphysics doesn't take. So metaphysical argue, for example, this is true because it's in the Bible, or this is true because it's been observed in nature. Nature tells us that this must be the case. Those sorts of claims.
Mm. I know that psychologically it's easier to come to terms with that by recognising not just that you have to take responsibility for the fact that you might be wrong, but actually in doing that you're actually accepting that you will be wrong to some extent. And it makes it easier from a psychological point of view.
Yeah, indeed, yeah. Yeah, yeah. There's that element of provisionality which is basically a psychological state. Yeah. There's some good stuff about this in Sartre, 20th century philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre, who particularly talks about people having to choose in their interpretation of a sign, particularly what they take as a sign from God. He talks about what is a Franciscan friend of his, a monk who, I think he went into medical work and helped the sick during the war or something like this, but found a lot of problems in his path, so he took this as a sign that God didn't want him to do medical work anymore. So he went back to the religious life. I may have got the details wrong there, but anyway, that sort of interpretation of the sign. And Sartre said, well, this guy was felt it was clear, you know, God had told him that was what he ought to do. But of course, there's all sorts of conditions involved, and there's his responsibility for interpreting that sign.
Mm. Just thinking of that book that you recommended, Being Wrong by Catherine Schultz.
Yeah,
well. That's great for that. Yeah. It sums me up.
Because that's a very readable book, actually, Being Wrong. It's not a difficult work of philosophy by any means, so
very enjoyable.
Yes, and just on the Sartre example, actually, the one of the classic ones of this is which really focuses this that two existentialist philosophers have talked about, Kierkegaard and Sartre, is Abraham and the sacrifice of Isaac.
Mm.
So when Abraham believed that God had told him in a dream that she should go to a certain place on a mountain and sacrifice his son Isaac. So he sets out on the journey in the biblical account, and he's already, he's got the file already and so on, and he's got the knife out and he's ready to kill Isaac. And at that moment, the angel comes and tells him, no, you don't need to do that. God's let you off. Both Kierkegaard and Sartre point out, well, this was Abraham's responsibility. You know, if he's going to kill his son, then he decided to do that. Mm. And us taking Abraham as a model is like a great example in the Western tradition of this sort of metaphysical tendency not to take responsibility even for these kinds of very difficult, to put it mildly, decisions or cruel decisions. Okay, so yeah, the widespread nature of metaphysical assumptions. So this again is something when I talk about metaphysics, people often then jump to the conclusion, okay, well, this is just something philosophers go on about, you know, it's not much relevance to practical life. But what makes this all relevant is the fact that metaphysical assumptions are all around us, they're all over the place. Although, you know, God and anti-God are sort of the ones that people think about most, and thus perhaps the most tempting ones to use for examples, actually it's not the most common. I would say the three most common, I think, are free will determinism, absolute moral beliefs, whether pro or con, so believing that something is completely right or completely wrong, completely good or evil, whatever, and the fixed self view, so I am like this, or I am not like this. those are all kinds of beliefs which fit into the account of metaphysics I've just given. If you think about, well, just a classic course of criminal behaviour, for example, that may or may not include free will beliefs and deterministic beliefs. So criminals believing that they can't help what they're doing, for example, or that perhaps it's sort of proof of power and independence in some cases, at least on the free will belief, but in either case, not really checked out against the complexity of what's involved in believing that we either completely control what we're doing or that we don't. Beliefs in the justification of a crime. Classically, as I understand it, criminals do tend to self-justify. They tend to say, well, this was the right thing to do in the circumstances. Perhaps because of their needs, or they might blame the victim or something like this. This is a classic thing for rapists to do, I think, isn't it, that they blame the victim. The fixed self view. See, that could be related to determinism. It could be, you know, I am like this, so therefore I can't help behaving in this way. But certainly a kind of belief that, you know, I can't change in the way I'm operating. Not only are those the most common views, but they're also interrelated in various ways, and that can illustrate some of the ways in which metaphysical beliefs are dependent, very often dependent on each other. You could just see them all as versions of each other in some ways.